to reflect for a moment on what understanding you have of the Mahayana bodhicitta altruistic intention to practice. Again, it's for us in the beginning, it's called effortful bodhicitta because it's so not our default mode to be, to think, oh my goodness, you know, I want to be like a perfect being so I can help others. I mean, the whole purpose for becoming a Buddha is to be able to perfectly guide others. That's not how I think, or most people that I know think. They're not, most of us are very self-centered, but this is completely opposite of that. So, you know, based on genuine love and compassion, which is something that we have to work on cultivating, we make this sort of amazing decision that I'm going to become enlightened in order to be the perfect guide for others. And I'm going to guide them from whatever state of misery and confusion they're in now to supreme enlightenment. And to do that, I know I've got to get there first. I've got to go first. So that is what my life, that's, as Lama Zopa says, that's the purpose of life. That is the purpose of life, is to become a Buddha, or get as far along the path as we can so that we can truly be of benefit to others. Not just in a temporal way, but in an ultimate way. Okay, so we can relax your concentration. Anything anybody needs to say or questions anybody wants to bring up right now?
I was wondering what the distinction is between when we say refuge in the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, and when we use this prayer and say the Supreme Assembly. Is that distinguishing the human realm from the celestial realms?
The Supreme Assembly, you mean in the refuge prayer?
Yes.
Yeah. Well, the Supreme Assembly basically is, they're the Sangha. They're the Arya Sangha, but they're also the Buddhas. I don't know if you've ever seen, there's a picture at the center called the Refuge Field. Okay, and it's all of these Buddhas and Bodhisattvas literally on a tree. That's generally what I think of as the Supreme Assembly, with all the, you know, with all the great, you know, like Chinrezi and Manjushri and Lama Tsongkhapa and so on like that. There's a refuge tree specifically for the Galupa tradition. And that's, again, that's what I think of as a Supreme Assembly. It's all good. Whatever it is, Supreme Assembly is all good.
Thank you.
Yeah. Any other questions? Okay. So, so I want to say a few things tonight, and some is going to be repetition, and I don't see a problem with repetition, you know, because there are some things in this class that I think are really important, and so I want to go over them almost every class. But tonight I want to talk a little bit about just what it, you know, where we stand in terms of being human beings. Most of us would say, you know, if you said, well, what's creating my world? I mean, where do things come from? It seems like there are at least three options, and maybe many more, But there's one of them is everything's random, right? And I think most people in our culture, maybe most people in the world, you know, people that don't have a really strong faith in something would say most things just happen randomly. You agree with that? Some people would say God, like the supreme being, who's like, you know, like a puppeteer pulling the strings, you know, and we're just little puppets, and this omnipotent, omniscient, omnipresent,
benevolent,
omni everything, you know, God has this amazing power. Some people would say that God is the creator. What do you think Buddhism thinks is the creator?
We are. Our own mind.
Yeah. And then I heard there was I love this Buddhist monk that I met in Thailand many years ago. His name was Achen Buddhadasa. I don't know if you ever heard of him, Buddhadasa Bhikkhu, but he was really considered to be a saint and in Thailand. And so, you know, I remember the first time I met him, I thought he was just one of the workers there. I was asking him for some directions, and I looked into his eyes and I thought, wow, who is this person? Anyway, when he finally gave some teachings, he was talking about, he said, Buddhism has a God, but it's an impersonal God. You know, most people think of God as, you know, personal relationship with God, but he said it's the laws of nature. He says, if you do this, you get that. If you do that, you get something else. So we come back to karma, don't we? The creative force from a Buddhist worldview is one's own karma, which is created by fundamentally our mind, but we say body, speech, and mind. Okay? So the creative force for our world is our karma. Now, this is something that you don't read, it's not in any of the readings or things like that, but I love this explanation, and I'd like to be challenged on it too if you want to. But anyway, what do you think the mechanism of karma? How does that work? How does karma create our world?
Well, in the readings, it said that really there's no way to know. We just have to accept it as one of Buddha's teachings. Like there's three ways of knowing.
Right.
So, but I don't know how the mechanism works.
Anybody got any ideas? It has something to do with emptiness.
Dependent arising.
Well, what do you mean by that?
Everything exists. Or nothing, things only exist because of something preceding it.
Something preceding it?
Preceding it, yes.
True. But how does that explain how karma basically...
Because everything has cause. There's no beginning, you know.
Now we're going. We're touching.
Going in circles.
We're touching a lot of juicy stuff. So let me let's see. This is one explanation, and it's one way to define emptiness too. By the way, so you know, again, all of you do most people know what we're talking about when we're talking about emptiness? Just some kind of at least the pedestrian understanding. Nod your head if you got some sense about emptiness. Yeah? Okay. So, you know, how many times have you heard it said that, well, there's nothing out there that exists inherently, right? Can you see my little bottle of water here?
Right.
Right. So if this was inherently a bottle of water, then, for example, I mean, all of us can agree it's a bottle of water. So from that perspective, you know, we're all on the same page, but a dog would come in and might see it as something to chew on. They might see it as a chew toy, you know, and everybody has a different perspective. So there, if there were any truly existent, inherent thing that exists independent of our mind, everybody would see it the same. I used the example last week of the red light, you know. When you're in a hurry and you come up to a red light, what do you see? It looks like your enemy, doesn't it? You get anxious, you get angry, you get upset. All of a sudden, your mind projects bad on the red light. Okay? Then, like, if you want to read a text message, and you go, oh, good, it's a red light. I got a couple of minutes here to read it. You know, now your perception of this red light is completely different. So the red light is not inherently good or bad from its own side, correct?
Correct.
It depends on what?
Our perception.
Our mind labeling it.
Yeah.
Where did the perception come from?
Our mind.
Yeah, our mind, but also, what, former moments of mind.
Yeah, from the previous moment.
Yeah, previous moments of mind. So for me to see that light as my enemy is the ripening of some former karmic imprint that ripened at that moment to force me to see the light in a certain way. Correct?
Yeah.
It's like a frame. You can think of karma as, we think of it as seeds ripening, but also you can think of it, if you're talking about visual consciousness, like a frame. Like right this minute, billions of karmic seeds are ripening in little frames that are forcing you to have the experience of being on your computer, listening to me, you know, being part of this class on karma. And constantly our karma is ripening like that. Because there's no existence out there independent of my mind labeling it. You know, you mentioned dependent arising. Everything arises or comes into existence independent upon causes and conditions. That's karma.
Mm-hmm.
It arises or it comes into existence independent upon its parts.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Mm-hmm.
Everything is made of parts.
Mm-hmm.
And everything arises or comes into existence independent upon a consciousness that labels it.
Mm-hmm.
And here's what's really cool about karma. You cannot change. You can tell me all day long that, hey, this is a pencil. You know in your heart of hearts, this is not a pencil. You can call it anything you want to, but you know it's a bottle, right? This is a water bottle. Okay? So our karma forces us. Our karma, it's our, Lama Zenpa calls it our karmic projection. Our karma forces us to see the world a certain way. Now, if you want to see the world as being like paradise and like a really cool place and your life going well, how would you do that? Given that we have some responsibility, right? That's one of the key points in karma, is that we are responsible. So if I want to see myself as being happy and, literally being in paradise, let's go all the way, even Buddhahood. If I want to see myself as being, you know, incredibly happy and like in paradise, how would I get there? How would I create the karmic imprints that would...
Change your thinking.
Pardon?
Change your thinking, your thoughts.
Change your thinking. Okay, but where? But our thinking is also our karma. So what is what actions? I'm going somewhere with this. Trust me. What actions of our body, speech, and mind are going to force us to see ourselves as happy? Virtue.
Mm-hmm.
Two-thirds of the Buddhist teachings are on ethics, living ethically, okay, on vows. So vows are a big, big part of the Dharma. You know, for example, in lay countries, well, let's, you know, getting, I don't want to get too far ahead of myself, but you see where I'm going with this? It's like, what I want to do is see myself. I want to be happy. I want to see myself surrounded by friends. I want to be successful, you know, materially and relationship wise and in my job. I want my life to go well. I want good things to happen to me and to the people in my life. You know, that's what I want to see. Okay. Now Buddhism says I'm responsible for, if that's not happening, I'm responsible for it. If it is happening, I'm responsible for it. How am I responsible for it? By my own former actions, because there's nothing that exists out there independent of my mind labeling it. And the cause for happiness, i.e. seeing things go well, is virtue. And the cause for seeing things go poorly is non-virtue. So virtue is defined, very interestingly in Buddhism, virtue is defined as the end result of an action is happiness. So if you do an action and the long-term consequence, end result, is your happiness, that action is virtuous. And if you do an action and the long-term consequences of that action is suffering, that action was non-virtuous. We talked last week about in the moment of doing an action in body, speech, and mind, because we cannot see into future lifetimes, because karma can ripen in this life, in the next life, or in 100 million lifetimes from now. We can't see that far into the future to know that this action is virtuous or not. So the best way we have, the two good ways we can do this. Again, this is very relevant to our own well-being and happiness. First is that we get so precise in understanding our intention, our motivation. Remember we said any action motivated by non-attachment, that's clinging, non-attachment. Any action motivated by non-hatred, aversion, that's sort of, you know, that kind of mind, that mind of aversion, hatred. Any mind not motivated by ignorance, any action motivated by non-attachment, non-hatred, non-ignorance will always result in happiness. Any action motivated by greed, hatred, and ignorance will always result in suffering. So we get back to the self-cherishing attitude, right? We talked about that last week a lot. The self-cherishing, selfish mind. Okay, we have this egocentric worldview. We think, and, you know, nothing bad or wrong, it's just a fact. We think we're the center of the universe. It's just how we're wired. Human beings are wired that way. And the only way we can ever become unwired is to see the illusion through the illusion of self and let go of it. But that's a whole nother module in discovering Buddhism. But you get back to the point here is that we want to be happy, and so we have to practice virtue because that plants the seeds on our mind stream that will ripen and force us to see ourselves as happy at some point in the future. At some point in the future. Now, the reason vows and ethics is such a big part of Buddhism is for this very reason, because they are the causes of happiness. They're not just trying to keep us in line. You know, I mean, maybe they are, but if you understand karma, if we understand and have some faith in the law of cause and effect, then we understand that actually behaving in an ethical way is in our own self interest. It does plant the seeds that will ripen in our future happiness. So if we're smart, we'll pay attention. Now, in most Buddhist countries, and of course, not everybody does all of these. As I remember, Venerable Raja Lama Zopa's attendant, he said, "Look, if you can just keep one of these, you're doing great. You know, you stand out like a star if you could just keep one vow." But the five lay vows in Buddhist countries are, I may get them wrong, so I'll try to be careful not to mess this up, but you don't kill, don't steal, don't commit adultery, don't lie, and don't get loaded. Killing, stealing, adultery, lying. No, yeah, killing, stealing, adultery, lying, and getting loaded, getting intoxicated, basically. Okay? So that's not, I mean, some of these are like no big deal. They sound like no big deal, but these are hard things to do, aren't they? I read something the other day where the average person lies at least 8 times a day. Because lying is a form of deception, isn't it? Exaggeration. My kids exaggerate something. I start telling them, look, that's a lie. I learned that in Buddhism. You know, when you exaggerate something, or when you sort of tacitly agree to something that you really don't agree to, you know, you're being deceptive. So we're talking about deception here when we're talking about lying. But anyway, so those are the five lay vows, okay? But then the Buddha teaches us the 10 non-virtues, and he says, look, just as minimum, as a Buddhist, you should strive for at least these three, these 10 things. There are three of body, four of speech, and three of mind, and they get heavier. So you can imagine, I mean, the karmic heaviness of these actions is the strongest is killing. So taking a life creates the heaviest negative karma, right? So the first of the non-virtues, to avoid killing, avoid stealing. No, wait, avoid killing. Yeah, avoid stealing. Avoid adultery, which is having, you know, sexual relations with somebody else's partner, basically. Those are three of my of body. Then the four of speech. Avoid lying, avoid slander, avoid harsh speech, and gossipy, frivolous speech. So the four of speech. And three of mind are greed, attachment, clinginess, hatred, aversion, ill will, and ignorance. And ignorance is vast. It's vast. Ignorance is not just not seeing that things are inherently existence, but it's also not having faith in your own potential to become enlightened, not having faith in past and future lifetimes, not having faith in the laws of karma, and so on. So those are all considered to be aspects of ignorance. So those are the things that we, you know, as much as possible, we should aspire to avoid. Why? Because when we, and by the way, if you take vows, I love this part, but you have to be a little, this is a little tricky. If you take vows, then you create, they say, you create virtue 24/7. Catch this one now. Pay attention. This is important. Take vows, you're creating virtue. Like if you take a vow not to kill, the only way you can create the positive karma of not killing is being put in a situation where you might take a life. But let's say an insect. let's say there's a cockroach on the floor, and you ordinarily you call yourself a Buddhist. You say, okay, I'm going to capture that cockroach and liberate it, take it outside and let it go. Okay, well, then you have consciously avoided killing, and that creates the positive karma of non-killing, right? But if you take a vow not to kill, then the teachers say that vows are so powerful in your mind stream that you're creating the positive karma of not killing, even when you're not confronted with a situation where you might take a life. Okay? And then the opposite of non-killing, which is non-killing, when avoiding killing is virtuous, no doubt. But actually saving lives is even another aspect of it. It's quite powerful. It creates the causes for us to be happy. Okay? Same thing with stealing. If we're in a situation where we could cheat or steal and we catch ourselves and we don't do it, that creates the positive karma of not stealing. Okay? If we have the vow not to steal, then we're getting in a positive karma 24/7. That's how powerful vows are in our mind stream. And then of course being generous, the opposite of being of stealing is sort of giving it away. Being generous is even more powerful. So you get the point. You get how this goes. Sexual misconduct or adultery and so forth, and how damaging that is. And we're in a situation where we could, if we just kind of let ourselves go, behave in a way that would be harmful to ourselves and others. But no, we restrain ourselves. And, going forward, we, practice skillfully. We behave ourselves basically in life and make good choices in terms of relationships and how we are with other people. And it just goes like that. So the 10 non-virtues are like, Of the things in this class that we need to get, this is one of the top three. This is number two. Number one is what? What are the four laws of karma or characteristics of karma or things like that we talked about last week? Anybody want to? Let's see. Who's going to take number one? Give me number one here.
Definitely.
Okay. Tell us about number one and what your understanding of it is.
Definite means that karma will ripen.
Okay. Well, karma will ripen. So let's see. John, you raised your hand. What do you want to say about that?
I was going to go into the next one. But I guess it's indefinite that positive seeds result in positive karma, result in happiness, and negative seeds result in suffering. I think that's part of the definite.
Yeah, exactly. So that's kind of an immutable law. Positive, you plant any kind of a seed, a grass seed, you're not going to get a tree. You're going to get what you plant. So it's like that. Positive leads to happiness, and destructive actions lead to suffering. All right, number two. Anybody else want to take number two, John? We don't want you to get all the good karma. Susan, you want to raise your hand?
I can do number two, then John can go to number three. The second law is that karmic seeds grow exponentially. So that you really need to be careful and review your actions every day and not miss any opportunities to get some good karma, because it'll really, it grows very quickly.
What's some other aspects, practical aspects of that teaching too? That was one of them, actually, what you just said.
The habit. It's kind of bad habits to get more bad habits and good habits to get more good habits.
Yeah. And also when we understand that that karma grows exponentially. I mean, it's like the tiniest little seed, the tiniest little seed. You know, I mean, maybe you have some example in your life where you said something that was a little bit snitty or nasty, but it ended up being like an atomic bomb of suffering that came on the end of that. Whereas a little tiny thing, and the longer we let it fester, the longer, the bigger the problem. So one of the message, you know, and by the same token, somebody who understands this and is mindful to not even create one little tiny negative karmic action, because it's going to grow like crazy. But also never wants to miss the opportunity to plant a positive karmic seed, like a smile, something as simple as smiling at somebody or making an offering to a charity that you have some faith in, or, you know, there's so many ways that we can plant positive karmic seeds, and not just by practicing Dharma, but in little actions that we do every single day. Yeah. So it's important that we understand that karma is growing exponentially, and that the longer, this is something that I really have taken to heart, and I have a lot of faith in karma, although I don't live my life that way a lot of the time. I'm sorry, but I'm a work in progress. Okay. But it's like, if I say something to somebody that I go, oh God, I did that. I want to clean it up so fast your head would spin. I want to go back and talk to that person immediately. I don't want to let it fester, because I know the karma is expanding. And the longer I wait, and I try to instill this in my children, but I haven't been very successful. But, you know, it's like, you know, go back and apologize now. Don't wait. Don't wait too long. Go back and say you're sorry. Make amends, you know. You know, let's clean up our messes as quick as we can. And then, of course, maybe the person that we've harmed is deceased, or we have created messes with people that we don't really, we can't even be in contact with on a regular basis, or even when we want to. So we can do spiritual practices to literally, I think of, you know, of like letting go. We talk about the 400 powers, but your point at the end of the day, because karma is growing so fast, and a tiny negative action done earlier in the day could be really huge by the time you go to bed, if we're not completely honest with ourselves about our choices, body, speech, and mind, right? Be really clear about where we have messed up, and then generate regrets. So again, the 400 powers, and I'm going to digress here for just a second, because this is the third most important teaching, I think, in this class. The first one of the four powers, first one is called refuge. It's basically taking refuge in the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, and in bodhicitta, in compassion. It's like the ground that we're standing on when we're doing these practices. The second one is regret. It's what, and you, we're not honest with ourselves, then what? We're not going to have any regret, right? So we have to really be brutally honest with ourselves. Did I do something that was unskillful? Did I do something that was motivated by self-cherishing selfishness that's going to ripen in future suffering? And if we see that we did, then we want to feel sincere regret about that. Then the third is the power of the remedy. And the remedy, sometimes we say, well, you know, I will teach you guys. I mean, you probably already know how to do the Vajrasattva, the little short Vajrasattva purification practice that you can do at bedtime. But we will do that next week for sure. Just remind me to do that. But that's important. But it's, we can do Vajrasattva, where you can memorize a little short mantra on Vajrasattva home, or you can memorize the 100-syllable mantra. I recommend, how many people that are here on this class have memorized the 100-syllable mantra? Raise your hand. Yeah, so a couple of people? Good. Because it is doable. It is doable. Took me one day, but I was a lot younger. My mind was a little sharper back in those days. But I memorized it in a day. It took me a whole day, but it was worth it. Good gosh, it was worth it. Let me tell you, it's probably saved, I don't know, I might be dead right now if I hadn't memorized that mantra. But so also the power of the remedy could be picking up the telephone, or next time you see that person apologizing. It could be something. We could be as creative as we needed to be to try to have, but it's a powerful gesture that really kind of embodies the sincerity of our regret. So it could be 100,000 frustrations, 100,000 Vajrasattva mantras, 100,000, or it could be just an apology or a donation, whatever. But you get the point. It's the power of the remedy, and we have to be creative about that. And the last and most important of the four blended powers is what? Raise your hand. Who's going? Somebody needs. Somebody maybe knows.
Promise.
Action is never lost.
Pardon?
An action is never lost. What we do, we cannot lost.
Oh, the rule of karma.
I'm still talking about the four potent powers.
That's resolve.
Yeah, the power of resolve. Resolve, yes. Which is to make a resolve that you're not going to do it again. That you're not going to do it again. Because somebody told me one time, a psychologist told me that, for example, and they were describing pedophiles, you know. It could be a father who's sexually abusing his child, and he talks to the wife, you know, the kid doesn't, but he says, oh, I'm so sorry, I just regret it, you know, I'm a terrible person, I'm really sorry, you know, but they never say, I'm never going to do it again, which is the most important part. And so just apologizing over and over and over again is the psychologists call this the cycle of abuse. Just apologizing is not enough. It has to come with some resolve that you're not going to do that for some period of time. For example, if you have a resolution that you're never going to get angry again, well, you know you're going to break that one, right? But you could have a resolution that, well, I'm not going to get angry for 1 minute. Something you can keep, a promise that you can keep. Or it might be an hour, or it might even be a day. You're going to promise that you're not going to get upset or angry for a day. Or if you, here's a cop out, the one I like the best, is I'm going to do my best to not get angry. Which is true, but it's actually much more powerful to give it a finite period of time. I have, I think people in AA, they have this saying that I think is very cool. I think it's a thing that they have. It's like, take it one day at a time. I think that's very powerful. Is that if we can just take, you know, whatever, and we all have our, each of us has sort of one delusion that's our predominant one. For some of us, it's greed, and for some of it, it's just anger, and for somebody else, it might be lust, and for somebody else, it might be fear, but, you know, it could be a lot of different things. But whatever our major karmic delusion is, that's the one that we need to work on the most. It's the one we need to put the most effort into. So we want to promise, so the power of the resolve to not do it again. So what are the four kind of powers again? I'm going to tell you. Refuge is the first. Regret is the second. The three R's. Remedy is the third. And resolve is the fourth. So that's, we're done with the course. That's it. That's all the juicy stuff. But now we have to fill in the, that's like the rough sketch. We just outlined this whole thing of karma. But, in the beginning we did talk about, well, there was a guy that came, a teacher that came in 25 or 6 years ago. And he gave a teaching on the marriage of karma and emptiness. And he basically told the class was about what I said earlier on. And so, you know, how karma and emptiness are intertwined. And in a real way, you could almost define, well, maybe I better be careful because I'm going to trip over my tongue here. But I mean, it's like, because there's no objective reality that exists independent of our mind, and what's creating our reality are all of these karmic seeds ripening, which are basically created by actions of virtue or non-virtue. So our whole life, our whole world depends upon, and our perception depends upon our past actions of virtue and non-virtue. Some of them were created, again, the power of the karma. For us to have karma to ripen in this lifetime, it has to be very, very powerful and repetitive. And for most of us, that's negative karma. It's not good karma. But it could be good karma, depending on the individual. But if it's, you know, if we have this habit of anger and we feed it all the time, it's not surprising that people don't want to be around us. Okay? It's not surprising. And maybe, just maybe, that's the karma ripening even in this lifetime. But a karmic seed a karmic action has to have several components to it. It has to have basically me and you, and then the action, and then it has the completion of the action. That's called a completed karmic action. That action actually has the potential to project us into a future lifetime. Okay? A completed. Then there are other karmic actions that are not so powerful, that don't have the potential they call it throwing karma, to throw us in, create a whole nother lifetime. But we think of these completed karmic actions. Like, for example, if you decided you were going to kill somebody and you went and got a gun and you identified the person and you shot him and then you rejoiced in it, that's a completed karmic action of killing. And that's a one-way ticket to the hell realms, so to speak. That would be a real hard one to clean up. Although Milarepa, who achieved enlightenment in the same lifetime that he killed 38 people. So, you know, it can be done, but he was a pretty extraordinary guy. Milarepa, back in the day. So let me pause for a moment and catch my breath. Any questions about where we're going with this so far? All right, so let's go ahead. So what's the third? So we're talking about the first law of karma is positive actions lead to happiness and negative actions lead to suffering. And then the second law is that karma is expandable. It's like grows exponentially. From the moment that tiny seed's planted, you know, like a little acorn becomes a, you know, ten ton oak tree. You know, just a little seed creates a big oak tree. Same thing with karma. All right, and then what's the third law? Who wants to go for that? This is real juicy.
Not victimless. You can't experience the effects of karma without having created the cause.
Exactly.
That's one of my favorites.
Yeah. So, you know, we in Buddhism, they there's another way that they say this, which is so convoluted. I can't even remember it now, but it's, you know, but I like it stated that way, that you cannot experience a result without creating the cause. So we are ultimately responsible. So everything is, this is a hard one though, because most of us want to be victims. That's our kind of default mode. How dare they do this to me? I don't deserve to be treated this way. You know, I'm a nice person. I didn't do anything to him. And he came in and shot me, you know, and he doesn't even know me. How could that possibly, you know, how could that have happened? I didn't do anything to him in this lifetime. but we don't know what we did in past lifetimes, do we? I mean, we have no clue. You know, according, this is going to blow your mind what I'm going to say, but I'm going to say it anyway. One teacher said, it's impossible to be truly virtuous if you don't believe in past and future lifetimes. What do you think that means? And first of all, you know, understanding karma, all of it happening in this lifetime doesn't quite fit, does it? That doesn't make a lot of sense either. If it just happened in this lifetime, because how do you explain, for example, babies being aborted, babies being born with all kinds of physical defects, mental defects, you name it. And then all the random stuff, seemingly random stuff that's not so good that happens to us in our lifetime that we don't seem to be connected to in any way. I mean, the day you went to work at the World Trade Center in 2001 on 9/11, you know, what did you do to deserve to get blown up? You know, a couple of jets flying into the building. You can't figure that one out. But according to Buddhism, according to John, what was the cause of that?
Past lifetimes. I mean,
what did you do in a past? What might you have done in a past lifetime that would have caused you to have your life taken in this lifetime?
I imagine it would be towards the top of the list of your 10 non-virtuous actions, killing.
Yeah,
you're killing other people, and then you'll experience the results.
Yeah, and you know, it might not even be people. It could, because karma is expandable, it could be even an animal or something smaller. I don't think it's a bad thing, but we don't have any cure now for the coronavirus yet. So as soon as we have something, but I don't think the COVID-19 coronavirus is a sentient being. I'm pretty sure about that one, but you know, I'm kind of hoping we can come up. I give antibiotics out during the day, and Lava's open told me, you know, because you're killing bacteria, and bacteria can, you know, you can see them move around and kind of wonder if they're sentient or not, all that kind of stuff. Don't overthink this, by the way, like I'm doing right now. But just use your good judgment, you know. But yeah, the causes of having of being killed in this lifetime is killing in former lifetimes. What do you think the causes of poverty are in this lifetime? You can't experience the result without creating the cause. What do you think the causes of not having any stuff?
You know, being miserly.
Greed. Stealing. You're muted, John. We can't hear you.
Muted. We can't hear you.
You gotta mute it.
Unmute. Okay. Can you hear me now?
Yep.
Okay. So
Kelly has a question, Don. Whenever you're done and have a minute, her hand.
Oh, okay. Gosh, I didn't.
Yes, I'm sorry.
All right, go for it, Kelly.
I think you should finish what you're talking about first.
Okay. So this is this is a hard one, you know, because this is actually telling, you know, this particular teaching is saying that we are responsible for everything that happens to us in our lives, be it good or bad. And also everybody else is responsible for their experience, be it good or bad. But that doesn't give us the license to say, well, that's just her karma. Or, you know, she's suffering and ignore people because of that. That's not what this is saying. This is not saying that at all. This is actually an incredibly powerful teaching that says that we can literally shape our lives, our future, because everything is empty and because we can make good choices and create the karma for future happiness, that we can literally shape our lives and our future to be happy by the choices that we make now, moment to moment to moment, from now until to the end of this life and into the next life and so on and so on. So yeah, we cannot experience the result without creating the cause. That's talking about accountability, responsibility, not being a victim. And yes, if somebody were to come in here right now and blow me away, you could say, well, Don's a victim. And you'd be right on a certain level, wouldn't you? Because that's what you call people that aren't doing anything. And I don't even know this person. They come in and blow me away. You could say I'm a victim. But from a Buddhist perspective, no victim here. That in some form or time, I must have harmed that other person, and now the karma is coming back to me. Now we have to see that this is a hard one, and people tend to, there's a lot of resistance to the notion of being 100% accountable for everything that happens in our lives, because we can find situations where we feel like we've been unfairly treated. But and from a conventional perspective, we may be exactly right. I'm talking about from a conventional perspective. But from the ultimate perspective of emptiness and karma, we cannot have a result that we didn't create the causes for. So that's really powerful. Really helpful. Anybody, any other thoughts about that? Kelly, is this not the question you want to talk
about? Well, it's kind of in this line. So karma in the current lifetime makes sense to me. You know, thoughts become things. If you treat people well, they treat you well back in general. But in a way, this idea that karma follows you around through the eons, it seems like an unnaturally cruel catch-22. You have a high percentage of children that are sexually abused. You have a high percentage of women that are beaten. Children that are born into families who are terrible. I mean, it's very common. And so they grow up angry and bitter and doing bad things to other people. And it's like, how can, and it happens to a huge number of people in the world. How can anybody ever, and so they have bad actions that then follow them around for eons. How can you ever get yourself out of that catch-22?
Good question. And we have a hand up in a minute, but let me just say this. I love, one of the great examples of karma, you know, I think Ajahn Buddhadasa said, it's the laws of nature. It's the God in Buddhism is this impersonal process of causality. It's not personal. It's like gravity is not personal. You drop something, flop, it's going to go down every time. If karma is like that, it's impersonal. And yeah, it is, I mean, we have this stream of consciousness, and in this lifetime, a lot of karmic seeds have ripened. And by the way, when a karmic seed ripens, let's say karma of suffering ripens, that karma's finished, right? It's like the plant's been pulled out. We don't have to suffer the consequences of that karma anymore. Now, if we react and get angry and do the same thing again in response to the suffering we experience, that just creates another round for us, right? That's called samsara. But we have this stream of consciousness, and it's collecting karma right now. We're experiencing the fruit of all of our former karma right this minute. This is all of our former karma from beginning this lifetime up until now is coming together to create our experience of this moment. But we did talk about purification, and we do have the power to purify our negative karma. We do have the power to, using the four opponent powers, to change our mind. And ultimately, when we see the emptiness of everything, when we can see the emptiness of everything, and we understand karma, there's tremendous potential for our minds. Now, that's not to say that there aren't a lot of people, men, women, children. I mean, there's a lot of horrible things that go on in this world. And we're not saying that that baby or that child is, quote, to blame. I think this is probably where I needed to get to some point on this thing. You can't experience the result without creating the cause. Doesn't mean the word blame sounds so negative, doesn't it? I'm to blame, or that baby or that child is to blame for being abused, or that woman is to blame for, she deserved what she got. That's not what this is not saying that. This is simply saying that every individual has their own karma, has their own sort of karmic baggage, and is constantly ripening and giving them the experience of, quote, my life. And so some people all the 20-some-hundred people, 2,000-some people that were in the Twin Towers that died, what terrible karma that was. I mean, we wouldn't say they were to blame. And we get in trouble if we try to say that they were, that's not the time to teach somebody about karma. Karma really benefits us individually in processing our own life's experience, not going around, saying, oh, that's your karma. That's not going to work. But for me to take responsibility and say, hey, I can't experience something without creating the cause, therefore I'm responsible, I'm accountable. Great news. I'm in a position to create a future that's like paradise if I make the right choices. That's really where the power of this law, of this particular law is. We can't experience the result without creating the causes, and we want to be happy, so let's create the causes for that. All right? Now, the fourth law of karma, what's that? Any hands going up? And John, you're getting all the good karma.
The result of an action is never lost.
Exactly.
Also, if I do a thing, then the result is there. Cannot explore lost. Okay.
The karma, all right, now there's a couple of caveats here. The karma is never lost. Karma is never lost. Except, okay, but if you plant a positive seed of karma, if you plant a seed of positive action, okay, we know it eventually will ripen. It will ripen into happiness. That seed is never lost until what happens? What has to happen? Come together. Cooperative causes, right?
Causes and conditions.
Yeah, causes and conditions. The cooperative causes come together. It's the karma is powerful enough. It's the right time. It's the right place. that karma can ripen. It could be a negative karma. It could be a positive karma. So the causes and conditions could come together for a karmic seed to ripen. So there are two things to keep in mind here. One is, and I debated this with Venerable George a couple of weeks ago. He won. He usually does. But I just don't understand how you can destroy positive karma. When this loss is that karma is never lost, how can you destroy positive karma? The teachers say you can destroy eons of positive karma in just a moment of anger. Holy moly. You work for eons for a little bit of good stuff, and all of a sudden you lose your mind for a minute and you blow it and destroy all this good karma. We just said karma's never lost. How do you destroy it, George? He said, if it's a seed in the ground and a crow comes down and reaches down and picks up that seed and eats it, it's gone. So yes, we can destroy our positive karma by heavy negative actions. We can destroy our positive karma. So in that sense, that karma is lost. Our positive karma is lost by negative actions. But by the same token, you know, the karma can be destroyed. That negative karma can be destroyed by purification. The four appointed powers. So if we can apply those four appointed powers, then this law is not 100% true, is it? Karmic seeds are never lost unless they're destroyed by anger or purified by applying the four appointed powers. That's, I think, the take home there. That makes sense? So give me the four karmic laws. Well, I'll tell you what. I want you to, let's do a little meditation again on just the four laws. We did this last time, and I'll bring it up, and I want you to think about how this might be practical for you in your life, okay? Oh, wait a minute. Got to back up a second. I didn't answer one question I posed. I said, one teacher said, that it's impossible to be really virtuous without having faith in past future lifetimes. What do you think they meant by that? It might be an overstatement, by the way, but it is provocative.
Could you say that again, Don?
So it's not possible to be truly virtuous. I'm talking about 24/7, 7 days a week. It's not possible to be truly virtuous without having faith in past and future lifetimes.
That's because of setting your intention to be virtuous instead of just kind of being virtuous by accident? That's my...
That's not talking about past and future lifetimes. Well,
I think that if you've got future lifetime, you've got consequences in your path, so that would lead you, so it's almost like forcing you to think of virtue and the consequences.
Yeah. See, I don't totally agree with that statement, but I do agree with this, that if I really believed that in the time it takes to, or finger snap, they say, the Buddhists say there's 60 mind moments in a finger snap, okay? So we're creating karma nonstop all the time, and it's going to ripen if it's virtuous, it's going to ripen in happiness, and if it's non-virtuous, it's going to ripen in suffering. And so if we truly, truly, truly believe, because right up to the time you die, you know, you're not going to be able to experience the fruit of any virtuous action that you perform 1 second before you die. in this lifetime, right? But you can in a future lifetime. So every moment of life is so precious. Every moment, if you believed that there were 60 opportunities to create positive karma and that finger snap, then we would be so mindful of being, we would be so careful. This is what I got from it, that even if I don't see the results in this lifetime, I'll see them in at some point in the future. And so I want to create as much as I can the causes for happiness, and to catch myself when I start going down that slippery slope toward the negative side of things, I catch myself and don't go there. The 24, you know, so that's how I take it, is that if we really believe in past and future lifetimes, first of all, karma, you know, doesn't make a lot of sense unless it's past lifetimes, right? Because otherwise you can't explain a lot of things that happen early in life that are so damaging. Good or bad. Why are some people born in the very opportune situations and some people born in, you know, in a nasty place and bad family and all this kind of stuff? So this is Buddhist, whether you buy it or not, this is the Buddhist reason for everything. This is why we have what we have and why we're going to get what we get is causing the laws of nature, basically. Kind of a very interesting thing to think about. And I, like I said last time, if we can begin to start thinking, even in just think about karma in this lifetime. Let's just even pretend like it's just this lifetime. You know, tomorrow, you know, if we're kinder to the people at work, I bet it won't be long before we have more friends. You know, and if we're mean to people at work, it won't be long before we have more enemies. So, you know, and if we're generous, and a lot of people have experienced when they become more generous or when they practice in accordance with the laws of karma, they see the results in this lifetime. So it's kind of cool. So I think that motivates me more than future lifetimes, frankly. I would like to believe that I live my life for the future lifetime, and I do in a way, but I really want it now. I'd like to have good things happen to me and my family now, but I need to do it with the right motivation, don't I? Otherwise, that's not Dharma at all. That's called the worldly Dharma. Not good. Okay. Let's do like a digestion meditation, which means we're going to sit for 4 minutes, and then we'll do the dedication, Karen. Can you put those up in a minute? We'll just take 3 or 4 minutes just to let all this conversation that we've had, which I think is, these are like the juiciest topics in all of Buddhism. So, you know, so cool that we've had a chance to talk about them and think about them. So let's contemplate these, at least the 4 points, if you can remember those. And one last thing, just to keep in mind, you know, when I think it's so important to remember that karma and emptiness, that, you know, they're intertwined. And it's, you know, one teacher gave the example of, like, you could almost imagine that, for example, emptiness is like a stage where there's really, there's nothing, or canvas. There's nothing on that canvas that exists from its own side. And that our karma is like the frames of the movie projector that are projecting our, this image called my life. Okay? And so everything is empty of inherent existence, of existing from its own side. And our karma forces us, really, we have, you know, it is literally ripening. You know, we don't have any control. We have control over the cooperative causes, but we don't have any control over the karma that's ripening, that's forcing us to have this experience of my life. It is ripening according to the laws of karma. So that's kind of a cool way to think about it. Is it? It's like there's this canvas, and the karma of the karma is like the frames of a movie projecting my life. You know. And if we don't like what we're seeing, we can do something about it. Okay, let's do the dedication verses. Karen, can you throw up the Shanti Deva's dedication? Thank you. Okay, so can you make them a little bigger? Yeah, that's good. That's good, yeah. Okay, thank you. All right. May all beings everywhere, plagued by sufferings of body and mind, paint an ocean of happiness and joy by virtue of my merits. May no living creature suffer, commit evil, or ever fall ill. May no one be afraid or belittled with the mind weighed down by depression. May the blind see forms and the deaf hear sounds. May those whose bodies are worn with toil be restored on finding repose. May the naked find clothing, the hungry find food. May the thirsty find water and delicious drinks. May the poor find wealth, those weak with sorrow find joy. May the forlorn find hope, constant happiness, and prosperity. May there be timely rains and bountiful harvest. May all medicines be effective and wholesome prayers bear fruit. May all who are sick and ill quickly be free from their ailments. Whatever diseases there are in the world, may these never occur again. May the frightened cease to be afraid, and may those bound be free. May the powerless find power, and may people think of benefiting each other. For as long as space remains, for as long as sentient beings remain, until then may I too remain to dispel the miseries of the world. Amen. And may our precious gurus have long and productive lives. Okay, well, thank you, everyone. The homework basically revolves around those four laws, but, you know, and let's try to be mindful of those this week. And if you know how to do the Vajrasattva purification practice, good to do that before you go to sleep at night. Have a good week, and I'll see you next time. Bye-bye.
Thanks so much. The homework's not posted yet, but keep checking because I'm sure Donna will be posting it.
Okay.
Soon.
All right. Thank you.